And good afternoon. We're in New Haven to do the nose today. And before we begin, I have something that I've been thinking about a lot this morning that I just wanted to share with you and maybe even start a groundswell. What I've been thinking about has to do with some remarks that were made by one of the closest advisors to President Trump, Kellyanne Conway, talking to Chris Matthews about the immigration bans and the rationale for them. Here's what she had to say.
These are nations very narrowly prescribed and also temporary.
Sure.
I bet there was very little coverage. I bet it's brand new information to people that President Obama had a six-month ban on the Iraqi refugee program after two Iraqis came here to this country, were radicalized, and they were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green massacre. Well, most people don't know that because it didn't get covered.
Now, the reason it didn't get covered is there was no Bowling Green massacre, all right? That's the reason it didn't get covered. That's one of the reasons it didn't get covered. But I think there's another reason. And I think it's because we really don't pay enough attention to people who die fictionally. So could I have some patriotic music, please? So what I'm suggesting is that there probably should be a vigil or a day of remembrance over the coming weekend for the victims of the Bowling Green massacre, even though it didn't happen. And I'd like to even maybe extend that out to victims of other fictional battles. For example, the Battle of Blackwater at King's Landing, the Siege of Gondor. You know, elves died at the Siege of Gondor. And when you think about it, you know, elves supposedly live forever. I think they're immortal, right? So it's not like, you know, they had 20 good years left. I mean, when an elf dies, that's presumably a bigger deal. And what about the zombies on The Walking Dead? When you think about the fact that they're zombies, so they sort of died already, and then people on The Walking Dead kill them, all right? So what I'm suggesting is it's not just the massacre at Bowling Green, although that was terrible, if imaginary. But how about if we spend a little time in quiet reflection over the weekend for all kinds of people and elves and zombies who have given their lives in the course of entertaining us and inflaming our passions. That's really all I have to say, but thank you for listening. Worship as you choose over the weekend. All right, so it's time to get right into the nose.
Show's over now. Yeah, that was good.
Thanks for tuning in. So the voice you hear there is Mark Oppenheimer. He's here to do the nose. He's editor-at-large for Tablet Magazine, and he's the host of the podcast Unorthodox, which is a great show about Jewish life and Jewish issues in America, but they also feature a Gentile of the Week. I'm a two-time Gentile of
the Week.
You're
the only ever two-time Gentile of the Week.
I want to go for three, too.
It is
Tell
done.
Me what I have to do. Who do I have to bribe?
It shall be done.
Yeah. Because really, if some cash has to change hands, that's fine. Lucy Gelman is here. She's a reporter for the New Haven Independent and a host at WNHH. Mercy Quay, let me see if I can get your new job correct. She's handling communications now for Educators for Excellence. Is that correct?
Yep, that's
all right.
It.
These are all – actually, you got this configuration of the New Haven Nose has appeared once before together. So – and the chemistry was fabulous. It will be so again. So
– we singed the paint off the walls of the studio.
Oh, it was just it was electric. So the first thing we're going to talk about is a series appearing on Amazon Television right now. It's called Sneaky Pete. It allegedly, theoretically, takes place in Trumbull, Connecticut, and peers into Bridgeport, Connecticut. It features Giovanni Ribisi as a con man living among other con people who are, well, he's a con man getting out of prison and invading this family under false pretenses. But it turns out they've all got their little secrets and cons that are running on each other, too. Let's hear a little bit from the series. The series begins with this recalling of a childhood time on a beautiful kind of farmlandish countryside in Trumbull, Connecticut, which I'm also pretty sure doesn't exist, but maybe it does. So let's hear a little of that.
I'm telling you, apples ain't the same anymore. I mean, I don't know what they did.
Pete, would you shut the hell up? Nothing's the same anymore.
3 years in here. I feel like I've spent every moment of that listening to this crap.
Pete had the perfect summers. Pete had the perfect grandparents. All that money from the bond business, but they loved you anyways. They had the time for you until Mommy pissed them out 20 years ago.
They did.
It's all true. And it just pisses you off because it was better than your screwed up life, whatever that was.
I know your life sucked worse than mine.
At least I have people skills.
You're a con man.
Yes, I'm a confidence man. I give people confidence, they give me their money. You, what, you tried to rob a gun range at gunpoint? I get out of here in 2 days. You're not even up for parole for another 2 years, which means my life is currently better than yours. So I either had a better life than you, or none of that crap means nothing. Either way, just stop talking about it. Okay?
So what you hear in that clip are two cellmates in a prison talking. One of them is talking about the idyllic childhood he had, where the apples tasted better and the grass was greener. He's not getting out for a few years. The guy he's talking to, the character played by Giovanni Ribisi, is getting out like tomorrow. And he decides, pretty predictably for a con man, to go back and join that family, pretending to be the man who's actually still in prison. So, Mark Oppenheimer, it's your fault that we watched all this.
Because you had already watched it on you, right? There's a number of things I like about it. Number one, I'm a sucker for a good con movie and also gambling movie, and they often go hand in hand. And the movie that I watch again and again and again when I can't figure out what else to watch is Rounders. So it tells you something about my taste. I like The Spanish Prisoner. I like con movies, and this is a con series on Amazon Prime, as we call it. But it also is very interesting because it takes, as that clip alluded to, Connecticut as its text, which is, if you want to con your way into a better life, go attach yourself under false pretenses to a family in suburban Connecticut. The funny thing is that the idyllic Connecticut that it selects is part Trumbull, and then they segue into Bridgeport from time to time. So, now it's not that there aren't lovely parts of Trumbull and Bridgeport, and indeed all cities in Connecticut have their lovely parts. It's just that, you'd think if a little more research had gone in, they might have selected New Canaan or Barkhamsted or who knows, right? But it's Trumbull and Bridgeport, and then they get it all wrong. I mean, and when they do a scene in New Haven in episode 7 or 8, it's way tonier than New Haven. I mean, it's Cambridge, basically, or it's Princeton, New Jersey. It's much more, or it's Oxford, England. And so they just, but the idea is that Connecticut is this nirvana, and if you're gonna, and whereas New York City is hell,
right.
So it toggles between the two a lot. And I think it's just a very, it also maps onto, I think, a kind of nostalgia that runs through our politics as well, which is that there's this America where the apples were greener, and if you get out of hell, you can go rejoin that America. So I find it I am also just very compelled by Giovanni Ribisi. I find him very watchable.
Yeah, I want to talk about Giovanni, but Mercy, I mean, that nostalgia is, it's both evoked and then dashed to the ground. There's this notion that there's this place that you can go where the grass is greener and the apples. But the minute he gets there, he's told, oh no, that's all gone. And I do find that a kind of Trumpian message.
Oh, yeah.
That, that the family business is just about to go under. Everybody's in one way or another screwed.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also this moment where, he's in the old family's house and he's talking to grandma and he's like, so how's the bonds and the stocks and bonds business that you're going through, right? Because, I mean, he's assumed this idealized family that his cellmate has come from, and they're just like, oh, you're a 10-year-old mind, right? We're bell bonds.
Different bonds.
Right. And I think, it's a little bit of bait and switch, but what I like about it is this entire series is a little bit of bait and switch. I didn't know what I was coming into. I enjoy coming into TV shows without learning much about, the context, learning much about who created it, which I later found out was the creator of House and Bryan Cranston. I come in and I'm just like, okay, so first scene, this is going to be about prison. Wait, no, this is not going to be about prison. This is going to be about a con man. And how long does that, how long can that last, right? Turns out, this is what happens if you take, I don't know, Catch Me If You Can, and spread it over 2 seasons.
Right. And, Lucy, I find with culture that I consume these days, I'm often trying to figure out what key it's in, and I had a little bit of a struggle. This is often kind of funny. You even hear that in that first clip where the guy who's not getting out of prison tried to rob a gun range at gunpoint. You know, there's a sort of a lot of that kind of stuff. It's thrown away. It's not really landed as a joke. There is a moment later on where Cranston, who plays this kind of arch criminal, this uber crime lord, who they had been attempting to con, realizes that the long con that's been run on him is the plot of The Sting. They've just taken the plot of The Sting and tried to execute it. And he looks at them with a kind of perplexity. And I thought that was really funny.
Oh, it was. It is funny. I mean, I think the show, Colin, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I think this is really pleasant. I sort of said as much before the show, but I wasn't super, super into it. I've seen it 3 episodes at this point. So, and I can see finishing the season, but to continue the musical analogy, I guess, if you will, I think this is sort of like any kind of pleasant but middling pop song that you might hear on one of the top stations. It's enough to stick with, but beyond that, I wasn't really, really captivated. I should also say I'm someone who does not watch a ton of television. I don't have a lot of time for TV, and usually I'll spend it on movies instead. Mm-hmm.
Are you implying the rest of us have nothing to do with our time?
No, not at all.
I don't have a lot of time for that.
No, not at all.
TV.
And I do enjoy really compelling TV. I think I didn't find this. It just wasn't my thing.
Yeah, there is a way in which it kind of lands in this middle register, which is it's not great. You know, you're not watching greatness,
right.
And it's not aware of its own failings, right? There are shows that are cheesy and silly, and they know that they're half baked and cheesy and silly, and they kind of revel in it. This one is a way in which it's kind of failed highbrow. That said, the casting is astonishing. I mean, there was when it was reviewed twice in the Times. They ran the pilot about a year ago, and then they basically spooled out the next 9 episodes a year later, and it got a review each time. And someone pointed out, you know, one thing that it really has going for it is the casting. I mean, you put Bryan Cranston and Giovanni Ribisi and Margot Martindale and all these great character actors together. It's at least fun to look at. The writing kind of, you know, yeah.
I mean, and you know, what I think kills it for me is that, you know, it should be pretty easy to sell a show if you place it in a place that's familiar, at least to, you know, the people from that area, right? And we're all sitting here, we're from Connecticut, and we're like, wait a second, because it's not, it sort of just name drops. And I think, Colin, you made reference to this in the emails. It's sort of just, you know, name drops without any sort of authenticity, right?
Totally.
It's like you don't actually see any real parts of Trumbull, Bridgeport, or New Haven, right? It all just, you feel it, but you're not really there.
It's probably filmed in Toronto.
The one part of Connecticut that it kind of gets right is a piece of Connecticut that 95% of people in Connecticut don't know. It's this part.
You look tired.
Studying for the exam.
Oh, yeah? How's that going?
It's going. Did you know in the state of Connecticut, for a pickle to be considered a pickle, it must bounce?
You're studying to become a food inspector?
Taylor's going to take his detective exam again.
Well, at least he's trying to accomplish that.
So there's one of the characters is this kind of overgrown kid who's a Bridgeport cop. He's the guy who's talking about studying for that exam in this kind of semi-dysfunctional family. So, you know, that sort of sounded familiar to me. I mean, I've been a reporter or journalist or whatever it is I've been in Connecticut for since 1975. So there's like a lot of the stuff that you kind of latently know. And it turns out, I mean, there is, I think this is all shared with all of you now. There is some basis for this, right? I mean, although not on the books, right? That there's this notion, somebody dug up this pickle thing and it has some reality.
So what's the reality to it?
The reality, okay. The reality to it goes back to the late 1940s when, in fact, there were these pickle fiends. These guys who were pickle, they were making and selling bad pickles. And so I think the question was, well, how are you going to prosecute them? And the Commissioner of Agriculture, Frederick Holcomb, said that, well, one thing is that the pickles should bounce. And I think he kind of made that up.
Well, that's why Commissioner Holcomb is one of our most highly regarded former commissioners of agriculture from the mid-war era.
Actually, I believe that I knew his son, Archie Holcomb, who also, I think, was either a commissioner of agriculture or something like that, too. So it's like a hereditary tyranny.
Well, I guess, you know, my point on this is really, this is another one of those things that is, it's approachable Connecticut, but it's not authentically Connecticut,
right?
I mean, because if you wanted it to place it in some kind of, you know, authenticity for Connecticut, talk about hamburgers or pizza, you know, right? You know, or something that is, you know, known in Bridgeport. I can't name that right now. But the pickle thing seems like a Google search.
That's true. It's kind of a, it was a wasted opportunity that way. They could have given it. What is it they call when wine has a sense of place? Terroir. It could have had a sense of place, but I still, Giovanni, man.
We should say Giovanni Ribisi, who he hasn't really ever had the career that I would have thought he should have had. I remember him from The Boiler Room. I remember him as Scarlett Johansson's distracted husband in Lost in Translation. He has this very interesting face. He was a child actor. He has this face that's not an entirely trustworthy face.
He was in a great episode of The X-Files. He was in a great arc on Friends. He was lots of shows that Lucy never saw. He was he's a terrific character actor. He's totally compelling, but no, he's never had like that role.
He's always been a supporting, right?
Always, and
not even like a an Oscar-winning supporting actor.
That's right.
Sort of just, I mean,
like Bryan Cranston, like super supporting actor, right?
I mean, I recall him, and you know, it was sort of, and I'm happy you mentioned that he has a familiar face because that's kind of what it is. I can't quite remember where I remember
I
this
that
guy
dude.
From, right? For me, it was that he was Lyndon Johnson's aide in Selma.
Whoa.
Right.
For me, it said he's the older brother of Marissa Ribisi, who was in Dazed and Confused. And then nothing else ever again.
And also his twin sister is married to Beck. And he's a Scientologist. We know a lot about Giovanni Ribisi at this point. But yeah, I would say even as a supporting actor, he's not the kind of supporting actor who works all the time.
That's right.
Margot Martindale, who's in this as the mater familias of this clan, works all the time. She
is that
has
a word? Mater familias?
I just made it up, maybe.
Awesome.
Now it is.
Awesome.
And the pater familias, Peter Garrity, people know him from probably in particular The Wire, where he's the one kind of judge who's disposed to Dominic West, McNulty's view of crime and stuff like that. But he also works. He's got about 100 credits, as does Margot Martindale. A lot of these people work a lot.
Right.
By the way, the first thug they deal with is Dominic Lombardozzi, also was in The Wire. There's a lot of people in this thing that you know from other places. You've seen them.
It's good comfort food. I recommend it's good comfort food.
That's exactly what it is.
It's meatloaf.
I mean, yeah, I think Mercy and Lucy are correct that it doesn't have the compellingness, say, of Breaking Bad, another Cranston project, where you just like had to know what was going to happen in the next episode. You're not going to feel that way, but you may.
I mean, if you're in the show hole, pick this one up.
Right.
The show hole, I like that.
Yeah.
Show hole?
That's
when you don't know what to watch next.
Right. Exactly.
And then when you do that, you should imagine that Lucy Gelman is doing something much more purposeful.
Yeah. She's watching a Nouvelle Vague.
My God, I'm never going to live it down.
She's reviewing Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yeah, you should experience a frisson of guilt.
That's right.
Your middle brow tendencies. All right, so we have to move on here. There's a huge event coming up this weekend, an event that unites the entire country. That, of course, is the birthday of both Jonathan McNichol and Betsy Kaplan. They're two full-time producers to the show. Only two actual full-time producers on this show, Jonathan McNichol and Betsy Kaplan. They have the same birthday. It's really odd.
Wow.
There's some other event. It's called the Super Bowl. I think a lot of people watch it. And, you know, actually, let me just sort of say, in the past, what we've done almost every year, maybe every year that I've been on the air, is that on Monday we come on the air and we analyze all the commercials, because the commercials, which now cost $5 million per 30 seconds, you do a one-minute ad, you're spending $10 million on a commercial. So much production goes into them, so much theoretically, so much innovation and thought goes into them, that they are events in and of themselves. We're not doing that this year because I don't care about the commercials. I mean, there just seem to be so many more things that are so much more compelling. But one thing that we did want to talk about, Mercy, is the sense anyway that this time we're going through a period where everything gets read the way that it was maybe put out, but then also read or decoded for all of the concerns that people have right now. And oddly enough, a lot of these commercials have, there's two of these major commercials have immigration themes to them, almost improbably.
Oh, wait, what's the other one? I recognize Budweiser.
Well, then there's this 84 Lumber thing that shows, it's maybe the biggest controversy, which is this company 84 Lumber put together this ad, and I think it's kind of a multi-part story or something about this Mexican mother and daughter who are trying to cross the border. And it was censored. They made them take out one part of the storyboard that had them coming to a wall.
And by the way, sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just saying, by the way, I once did a column on an ad. I wrote a religion column on an ad that had been produced but then censored, and someone pointed out to me they knew it was going to be censored and they wanted someone to do a column on how the ad, like, there are ads that they make or versions of ads they make knowing that the networks won't air them because they have certain rules. They don't want anything to be too political or too controversial. But then they know, what with the interwebs and all, like, you get this bounce of like, check out the version that was too hot for Fox or CBS to air. So
I mean, you know, so I'm in the field of communications now, and I am just, you know, enveloped with the idea of corporate social responsibility, which is that, you know, a corporation takes on a cause, something, tries to connect with their audience in some way, or tries to kind of put their finger to the temperature of the country in some meaningful way. You see Tylenol has done that, right, with What Matters Most campaign. And the one that I think really strums at the heartstrings of Americans right now is, you know, I didn't know about this, the one that you're mentioning here, but, you know, Budweiser and Audi's commercial, right? Audi's equal pay commercial. That, I mean, it's very bluntly, you know, and I think, and let me back up for a second, it's a father talking about his daughter, right? I mean, I think if there's any better way to get to those who don't find themselves to be
To Oppenheimer anyway.
Right. Any way to get to those who don't find themselves to be, you know, natural feminists, right? I think putting it, letting them see the perspective of a father who's just, you know, I'm a regular guy, right?
Yes.
And my daughter's doing regular things, but there are real there are realities that we're going to have to face. And what do I say in that moment? How do I face that? Mm-hmm. And I really just appreciate, I mean, it could be the, you know, activist in me, the community organizer in me, but I really just appreciate when corporations take on that responsibility to say, listen, we care about this too.
Well, I think also, so I thought that the Budweiser sort of Anheuser-Busch commercial was really, really interesting, Mercy and Mark, for a different reason.
Do you want to quickly describe it for people?
Oh, yeah, sure. So this commercial opens with a very beautifully shot, I guess, a montage of Adolphus Busch coming to the U.S. in the 1850s from Germany. And you kind of go between a bar where he meets, first name, and then, of course, Anheuser, mm-hmm. And they
Jimmy Anheuser,
Marty
Scooty, but
and they shake hands, and he has kind of a schematic of a beer bottle, and then how this operation is going to go down. But you go between that and seeing him on sort of en route to America on a ship that sort of is on these tumultuous seas, getting thrown back and forth, and then arriving and having people say, go home, you're not welcome here, you're not welcome here. And some people have been reading that with an immigration lens. What I think is so interesting is this is a major beer company's attempt at sort of rewriting or trying to show that they have this, you know, compelling, very human angle, I think. And if you think about the 2015 contract that Anheuser-Busch signed with SABMiller, like, they basically were putting a ton of craft beer producers and manufacturers out of business by signing that contract. And so I think this message of everyone is welcome here, this very touching, you know, intended to pull at your heartstrings sort of montage, it is them trying to not say we're this major sort of soulless company.
Although, yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm glad you make this point. And it certainly, there's inevitably something behind the commercial. By the way, Mark, have you managed somehow to remember the name of Mr. Anheuser?
I have not. Do you know what it was, Colin?
Well, I was going to let you pretend.
Jonathan, the producer, put up for us Eberhard Anheuser. Eberhard.
So, I always sort of balance that. Okay, everything that you say is absolutely true. Then, but here they are with $10 million on the line. It's a one-minute commercial. You know, they're talking to the biggest American audience that exists, the Super Bowl audience. And they do try to say something about, I mean, there's even, I think, a line, you don't look like you belong here.
This is something very important about our political moment, which is that you have to remember that one of the checks we have against, you know, for me as a liberal, my worst fears about the current administration is actually the marketplace, right? That is the fact that, you know, if you are a large corporation, you still want to sell to LGBT communities, Latino communities, immigrant community, undocumented people buy your beer. They buy your tacos. They buy your burgers. They buy your, you know, pregnancy tests. They buy your, you know, seed for farms. They buy whatever product you have, they buy it the way the rest of us buy it. And so the marketplace is in some ways a great democratizer and a check against some of my, you know, worst fears. But I do want to say I agree with Lucy. I mean, I think it's great if they – I mean, I love the Audi ad. If I had $60,000, that would be the next car I would buy, no question. It's like if I didn't want to send one of my children to college for 1 year.
And your problem is you have too many daughters to buy the car that would make you feel good about
My daughters. But I do want to say, I mean, it is a far cry from the days when corporate responsibility for people like Mellon and you know, meant building libraries. I mean, where's the company in New Haven or Hartford that's actually building us swimming pools and libraries and saying we're going to give back to the city? Where that like almost doesn't exist anymore. No one even expects it. And that's a kind of shocking come down from where we once were. And those were bad dudes. But when they atoned with like real public works.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, one thing you have to say about the difference between marketing and democracy is you don't have to win as many hearts and minds with marketing. You can afford to lose. I mean, you know, in other words, if you're selling 20% of the toothpaste in America, you're doing great. If you get 20% of the popular vote, you're not doing so well. So that's kind of the difference, that you can be a little bit more segmented. But the one thing that I'll just say as we head into break that makes the Super Bowl kind of interesting is there's so much on the line. I was listening to Tom Ashbrook's show driving down here today, and I was reminded of the fact that I think in 1993, In Living Color put on like their own alternative halftime show, because in fact halftime shows weren't that interesting at that point. And the broadcasting network lost 22.4% of its halftime audience and didn't get it back. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's one of the reasons
the network showing the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
they lost it to Fox, which had In Living Color.
So that, you know, that was why Michael Jackson was the Super Bowl halftime act the next year. And that, you know, so yeah, I mean, it is sort of true that in marketing you can lose huge segments of the audience and still sort of be okay, but not when you play at this level. When the commercials cost $10 million, they better speak to a lot of people.
And I also want to just add, you know, if Pfizer donates a playground, right, I mean, it's still Pfizer, right? I mean, there's a certain measure to this. That's like, when it comes to the stakes that the Super Bowl has, you can either say Snickers had a real bad fumble a few years ago. It was kind of a homophobic, I don't know if you remember this, Colin, but there was a bit of a homophobic commercial. You can say something that people will remember and reap the benefits of it, or you can just be another run of the mill, right? And I think organizations or corporations like Uber are finding themselves against the odds right now, and Lyft is actually in a very real way capitalizing on this moment where people are caring about what you as a corporation are saying to not a single community, which is what a library or a playground would do, but to everyone.
All right. We really have to go to a break now. We actually have six topics today, which we're not going to get to. We'll get to at least two more after this.
No matter where I go, no matter what I do, there's a demon chasing me. Commercial advertising, why won't you set me free? Each morning, noon and...
All right, so this is a little bit of a story that's been kicking around all week. It takes place nearby us. We're down in New Haven today, by the way, to do the nose with Mercy Quay and Lucy Gelman and Mark Oppenheimer. There's an essay contest in the beautiful town of Westport. It's sponsored, I think, co-sponsored by the library, and then something called Together Effectively Achieving Multiculturalism. That's as an acronym, TEAM, and is sort of their diversity council. It's an essay contest, and the instructions go like this. The focus of this fourth essay contest is the issue of white privilege, which surfaced as a topic during the recent presidential election. This year's invitation states, in 1,000 words or less, describe how you understand the term white privilege. To what extent do you think this privilege exists? What impact do you think it has had on your life, whatever your racial or ethnic identity, and in our society more broadly? So there's been a lot of coverage of this, and it's gotten outside Connecticut. It's turning up in a lot of national publications. And Mark, one of the things that the coverage says is that this has gotten people's fur bristling up on their backs. Although, like, I feel like I've read the same repurposed AP story everywhere that quotes the same four people.
Right. I mean, I think that from the coverage I saw seemed to be saying there was this essay contest. Then there were these racists in Westport who said we shouldn't talk about white privilege because it doesn't exist. And we know there was these racists in Westport who said that. And by the way, it's not clear that to say that makes you a racist, but that's the sort of spin that you're getting. But we know that these people exist because Twitter and comment sections on a local blog. And to me, I mean, you know, I have a number of thoughts of this, but I'll just limit myself for the moment to saying, like, the only people on Twitter, as my great friend Alana Newhouse says, are journalists and racists. I would add celebrities, right? But, like, Twitter is a microcosm of public commentary. Facebook is a million little microcosms. And the comment section, as Colin knows in radio, you know, there are listeners and then there are callers. And a lot of the callers are insane. And you get them again and again. I mean, the people of the time to figure out how to log in and then put a comment are often people with too much time on their hands who are, you know, playing Pac-Man 2 in their grandmother's basement. And we just don't know that there was – that Westport felt anything about this. And if so, what it was based on the reporting that we've gotten. So, you know, it could just be that most people are just happy to have an essay contest coming out of the public library, you know?
True. I mean, let's give some credit to the original AP reporter who actually I think found four living human beings to interview. But that's not much. And I think it was like 3-1. Like there was one guy who kind of liked the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, he was into it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm not even sure exactly what the topic. I mean, I will say this, that if in fact there is a sense of pushback from Westport or anybody else, it did make me think about this, the phrase white privilege, which is an absolutely true phrase that's based on, you know, all kinds of verities about the American human condition and everything. But I'm wondering how useful a phrase it is, you know? It seems to me that that for the converted people, the people who already understand this and believe in this, it has its own power and it's a shorthand for a whole bunch of other things. But if you're not converted, or if you're the kind of person, you know, who doesn't like being told these kinds of things, there's something a little scolding about the phrase itself. I'm wondering if there's a better way even to express that than white privilege.
Well, I think that's the way, just jumping in here, you know, it reminded me very much of the fact that still, I think one can talk about in their social circles racism as a construct and have very productive discussions. But the moment that one, and this is especially true in journalism and kind of the question about terms that you choose to use or not to use, the moment that someone uses the term racist to describe a person, the person is immediately up in arms. Even if, in fact, the actions that they have been doing are associated with racism, right? And so I think white privilege kind of follows in those footsteps. And sometimes if people are saddled with the term, Colin, I think folks don't always know what to do with it. I've been thinking a lot about Lydia Diamond's Smart People, which will be at Long Wharf Theater next month and into April. And it takes four sort of very smart Harvard-educated two professors, an actress, and a doctor, all of whom can't talk about race. So there are four different races. Two of them work on race as a kind of as a construct, and yet they are completely unable to speak candidly about race when they get together. And I think that's one of the things we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, I guess to your point, I was having a conversation with a friend who, you know, when she was asking, okay, well, why is saying all lives matter not good, right? And I said, well, it's because it's the erasure of blackness disguised as inclusion, right? And then she goes, that is thick. That language is thick, and you're not going to reach anyone with that kind of language. And sort of, at that point, I started to kind of pull in and think, the entire language around race is really thick and derives from academics, right? So we sit down and we ponder the theories of life and, you know, how can we relate and you know, culture and all this. But that happens in spheres of academics and in college dorms where people are trying to be a little bit more highbrow. So the Lucy Gelmans of the world, right? But for the, I'll say Mercy Quays of the world, so that I'm not picking on anyone else in the room. For the Mercy Quays of the world, it's a lot harder. Your fragility sort of starts to get roused up when you hear things like that seem targeting, like the phrase white privilege or racist.
Yeah. For example, with white privilege, White privilege was initially connected in some of the early sociological writing about it to a phrase that I like better, the invisible backpack. Do you know this phrase? Like the invisible backpack is this notion, for those of you listening who don't know it, that if you're white moving through America, even if you're not necessarily all that wealthy or anything like that, you have this invisible backpack full of guides and tools and locating devices. And it's all this stuff that you have that just goes with being white. And it's there in your invisible backpack. And it's hard to understand.
And it's an L.L. Bean backpack.
And it's an L.L. Bean backpack.
By the way. Maybe a JanSport or a Patagonia.
Well, the L.L. Bean has got it's getting very complicated.
Yeah,
anyway,
With New Balance and L.L. Bean, both, it's like, what am I going to wear anymore now? They're both brands of the right. It's like, that's all white 42-year-olds have got. And taking that from us.
I mean, I think invisible backpacks, it feels less chiding somehow.
If I may take off my invisible backpack for a moment and take a tool out of it. You know, to me, a lot of the problem, right, so I would say Lucy, to your point earlier, one reason I think journalists should hesitate to call anyone a racist. And should one way we should think about our language is we don't know people's intentions. Mm-hmm. And I do think that a lot of people feel that if you name them X, Y, or Z, what you're saying is you're saying something about their mental state. And we can be more precise in describing what they did or what a system does without naming intentionality, because I barely know my own intentionality. And to me, that's a respect we pay to all the people we write about, be they black, white, rich, poor, et cetera. It's just like we have to acknowledge our own limitations about knowing their mindset. Mm-hmm. But I would also say about going to the invisible backpack. I mean, to Mercy, your point about how we talk about this stuff, I'd rather talk about it the way my dad, who, you know, sued people for racial discrimination, talked about it, which is like the white privileges, they get jobs easier. You know, I mean, if you can't tie it to something material, I may sound like a Bernie Sanders voter for a moment, if you can't tie it to something material, which is the loss of a job, I'm not saying it's not real, but I'm saying we have a lot of work we can do to build empathy by telling people what's the stuff that white people get because they're white, without lapsing into or wafting into ethereal language. We can talk about, well, they get paid more and they get jobs easier. And if we keep it in that realm, then a lot of people can say, yeah, okay, I see that. So I would agree with you that the kind of the language matters a lot.
Yeah, I mean, and I also think that the brand of racist, right? It seems terminal, right? I'm either fully a racist or I'm not, and that we don't allow a gray area, or actually, you know, the way we think about it is that there's no gray area in between. You are either a racist or you're not. As opposed to, for instance, I heard someone describe it as alcoholism, right? You're not an alcoholic because, every morning you wake up and you decide not to drink, right? Mm-hmm. Just the same way as every morning you wake up with these preconceived either notions or, you know, prejudices that just come with being an American sometimes, or whatever nationality you prescribe to. But you're not racist because you're not being racist in the moment, but you're not, or I'm screwing this up. you decide in every moment to not be racist.
You know, we have to pause there for a second, not for a break, but because every morning Donald Trump wakes up and presumably says, you know, today I'm not going to just talk about myself all day long. I'm going to talk about other things. I'm going to talk about important things. I'm not going to talk about things that seem petty aspects of my own self-aggrandizing character. And at the National Prayer Breakfast, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, the National Prayer Breakfast, here's how that worked.
We had tremendous success on The Apprentice, and when I ran for president, I had to leave the show. That's when I knew for sure I was doing it. And they hired a big, big movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to take my place. And we know how that turned out. The ratings went right down the tubes. It's been a total disaster. And Mark will never, ever bet against Trump again. And I want to just pray for Arnold, if we can, for those ratings, okay?
All right. Two of you here have been through either bar or bat mitzvahs, presumably. I'm not really familiar with that prayer.
I have not, in fact.
You've not been?
I wrote a book about him, but I didn't have one.
Really?
I just had to set the record straight there. Yeah. That you can turn. And nor is it required. You're a full Jew, even if you've never done it. So,
well, I was going to turn to you as the religion expert. You know,
turn to Lucy.
I turned to Lucy. All right. So, I mean, I don't know. The National Prayer Breakfast.
The National Prayer Breakfast is very not Jewish, by the way. I'm not saying they invite Jews, but it is really goyish. Like, if you want what's not Jewish, mayonnaise and the National Prayer Breakfast.
Well, I mean, to me, the question isn't, you know, anything in particular about the National Prayer Breakfast so much as this man makes no attempt to tailor his appropriateness to any event that he's going to. In other words, he is – this injection of show business ratings into the National Prayer, it just couldn't be a worse fit, I would assume.
I would agree completely. I think zero attempt, 0.00. If you can have like negative attempt, there's negative attempt there. Yeah, I mean,
it's like an anti-attempt.
Yeah, it is. And at the same time, I mean, part of me felt like when I saw the clip, which I think I saw shortly after reading the entire transcript of Trump's comments, well, and comments on the occasion of Black History Month,
mm-hmm.
Which were also really abysmal and kind of focused on the election and the media as his foes. But I wasn't surprised. I do think that, you know, it's something we can see and sort of roll our eyes at. But it is this distraction to the fact that Steve Bannon is about to wreak havoc, or in fact already is wreaking havoc on our country. But that is as political as I will get.
No, to me, there are two sets of questions here. One of them has to do with substance and policy. And the other one has to do with the deportment of this man, you know, and I think it's important to document the fact that his deportment is just so out of sync with almost every situation in which he finds himself.
I mean, I started tweeting every day with the new thing, whatever Donald Trump did that day, and then next to it saying, this is your daily reminder that this is not normal, right? I mean, you go to a prayer breakfast and you're supposed to speak about piety, or at least be pious to some degree, you know, humility, the good of all men, right? And I just see his performance as just that, a performance, not a set of, you know, not a speech of any kind, a performance as remember me during The Apprentice. Well, yeah, I'm still better than the other guy. And right. All his entire act is, I'm still better than the other guy. Whatever, doesn't matter what that other guy, who that other guy actually is, he's still better than me. He wants everyone to know.
Go ahead.
It's nice that he brings the same shtick to, you know, to a largely white Christian audience that he brings to Black History Month, though. I mean, I can't wait till his Passover message.
He already left Jews out of the Holocaust.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
That's
did Justin Trudeau, by the way. I mean, nobody wants to talk about the Holocaust as a Jewish phenomenon. And, you know, all of us were hurt by it. And you know, there's politics behind that as well. But I think with Trump, it will always be his own I mean, that is the beauty of having a narcissist as president. It's like he really is an equal. He is an equal. What?
Please let us know.
No, I mean, he really is an equal opportunity. You know, narcissists are always about themselves, no matter who their audience is. So,
nobody here, I'm assuming, watches Game of Thrones. I know you don't at this point.
None I tried, but Sid wouldn't watch it with me. I saw one episode was too violent, so I have to return to it myself at some point.
So as we close this segment, I just want to say there's a character named Arya, who's one of the young girls on Game of Thrones, and she's seen her family just devastated, and you know, father's head cut off and all this stuff. And she turns into this character who, as she tries to fall asleep in whatever situation she's in, she recites the names of all the people who have hurt her family, people whom she intends to kill as soon as she gets old enough and big enough. And I feel like I'm turning into Arya as I'm going to sleep. At night I'll say, you know, you insulted the Prime Minister of Australia. You left Jews out of the Holocaust. You talked about the ratings of the national. Like, I have to recite all these things every day just to remind myself that they're not normal, that I shouldn't habituate to them. So one thing we didn't have time to talk about, I mean, possibly the biggest event of all, is the declaration of Beyonce that there are Beyonce twins on the way. Beyonce and Z twins on the way. So let's at least end the segment here with the fabulous Beyonce.
Girl, keep running this mother. Girl, who run the world?
I was going to enter the white privilege essay contest, but our maid didn't finish my entry in time. Darn it, Consuela! Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Margot Martindale. All of our episodes are at WNPR.org/Colin, and starting next week, our 8 p.m. rerun moves to 9 p.m. for the next 100 days. We'll be back on Monday with a show about things that made Betsy Kaplan angry over the weekend. And now... back to Colin.
In fact, we're actually thinking about renaming our Monday show just Things That Made Betsy Kaplan Angry Over the Weekend. We'll call it The Scramble right now. But, I mean, it's just, you know, we have to be honest about what it really is. So it's time to endorse things. I feel as though I have – oh, I just want to reiterate the thing that was just said there. Starting – I don't know if this will bother anybody. Maybe nobody. But we usually rerun our 1 p.m. show at 8 p.m. starting next week. And going for about 100 days, we're running a program called Indivisible. An NPR program about the current political climate and the first 100 days of the Trump presidency. That'll run at 8 p.m. Our rerun starting Monday will run at 9 p.m. But try to stay calm anyway. So time to endorse. Who wants to go? Mark, you go first.
I just read an extraordinary book by a journalist named David Sachs, S-A-X, called The Revenge of Analog. And it's about how there are 50% more bookstores now than there were 10 years ago. There's about 500% more vinyl records being sold. Board games are huge. An increasing number of summer camps don't let kids bring technology. It's just about how people are actually finding profit and pleasure in returning to the analog away from the digital. And he makes an extremely strong case that this is not just a blip, that this is actually the pendulum swinging back. And I just found it a thrilling, thrilling read, The Revenge of Analog.
All right. That's a show. We could
do a whole show.
Lucy, what have you got for us?
Sure. I have two really quickly. The first is Zadie Smith's most recent novel, Swing Time. I finally got a chance to sit down and read it, and it's really wonderful. It has two women at its core, which I really enjoy when I'm reading. And the second is an exhibition at the Yale University Art Gallery. It just opened about 2 weeks ago. It's called Let Us March On, and it's photos from Lee Friedlander's Prayer Pilgrimage in Washington and Lee Friedlander's photos. It's an amazing show. It's curated by fellow LaTanya Autry, and it is really, really affecting. I've seen it twice, and I'll probably see it again. Hmm.
We should mention that the Yale Art Gallery also is free. Admission is free. It's an amazing thing.
So in the spirit of approachable language around progressive issues, I'm going to endorse Ngozi Adichie's book, We Should All Be Feminists. Mm. It's you know, your common person's intro to feminism. I think it's approachable yet authentic. And then I'll also do two TV shows, Chewing Gum, which is on Netflix. It is wildly entertaining, and I have no idea why. And This Is Us. If no one's made that endorsement yet, This Is Us. I think it's timely. I think it's provocative. I think it's great.
Totally.
And then this Sunday, if you're not completely entrenched in all that's going on with the Super Bowl, maybe you can wake up early in the morning and support Integrated Refugee for Immigrant Services, Run for Refugees.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we love that organization. Chris George was on with us on Monday. All right. So, because I have to endorse every week, I start to run out of things at a certain point, and I'm not 100% sure that I haven't already endorsed any of these things, or all of these things. It's possible. So I was thinking about things that are similar to Sneaky Pete. I actually thought that Goliath, which was a Billy Bob Thornton vehicle, also on Amazon early on, and is kind of a legal thriller, was better and more gripping. And if you didn't watch it, it kind of slid under the radar. And then he got like a Best Actor Golden Globe or something. And maybe that will wake people up to it. But it's a lot of fun. And it has that wonderful woman whose name I'm blocking right now. I won't even be able to come up with it.
Greta Gerwig.
No. It's a Greek name, and she's won all kinds of Tonys and stuff like that. And you don't get to see her on TV very
much. Olympia Dukakis.
No. Never mind. So there's that one. And then the one that I'm not allowed to talk about, which is the OA. This is on Netflix. It stars the amazing Britt Marling, who's kind of just a fascinating figure in the world of entertainment these days. It has all kinds of angelic and theological implications to it. It's very controversial. Not controversial in the sense that like it splits the audience right down the middle. You either love it or you hate it. I happen to be one of the people who loved it. I would encourage you to at least give that a try. I have to fill some time. You mentioned it.
So what I should have done instead of foisting Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, instead of foisting Sneaky Pete on you, was Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Has any of you watched Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
I have not.
No, but
with
Rachel Bloom? I heard snippets of it on NPR.
So this was apparently the lowest rated show of the year by some metric or other that was renewed. And it's about this woman, this lawyer, hilariously funny. It's a musical. It's an hour-long comedy musical. They did a 22-episode season, like old school, right? And it's about a lawyer who loves New York City but is kind of unhappy there, and she realizes she's in the the rat race. She's working too hard. And an old friend from West Covina, California, in the San Fernando Valley, happens into town and seems happy. So she drops everything and moves to like inland California, strip mall hell in the California desert, and works for a small law firm there and discovers happiness and sings songs about it. And it's just thrilling. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Well, first of all, that was an incredible summary of, like, you know, just off the top of your head, you really kind of, like...
I'm deep in. I am deep in.
Yeah. I will also mention, I'm very late to this party, but the book Euphoria by Lily King, I've just finished. A beautiful novel based loosely, and I think, you know, not terribly... not mapped very accurately onto the life of Margaret Mead as a young woman. He's just putting names up there right now.
McNichol is like...
Yeah. So I want to thank...
I got one more if we have, oh, we don't have time.
Yeah, yeah, real fast.
Can I say goodbye to my dog? My dog died this week, JJ. I just want to say goodbye to JJ Diggles von Puchenstein Oppenheimer. She was my first ever dog.
All right.
I miss her. Sorry to bring everyone down.
Dogs can hear radio in the afterlife. That's been...
Sweet.
The president mentioned that just the other day. So it's the kind of thing, anyway. If there was a Bowling
Green... My dog's running with Frederick Douglass.
If there
was
a Bowling Green massacre and Frederick Douglass is still alive, then dogs can hear radio in the afterlife. Thank you, Mark Oppenheimer, Lucy Gelman, and Mercy Quay.